Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Surgical Care Improvement Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron. Ms. Cameron, you may begin.
Thank you, Devin, and good morning, everyone. And thank you for joining us on this, our eighth conference call as part of the Surgical Care Improvement Project, IPG. This morning, we're pleased to have with us Dr. Dale Bratzler, who is the medical director for the Oklahoma Foundation for Medical Quality. But before we begin, I just want to give everyone an opportunity to log on to Jenny to access the materials for this morning's conference call if you haven't already done so. And again, the address for the Jenny website is jeny.ipro.org. And under the Hospital Quality Improvement Breakout Room, click on the Surgical Care Improvement Project link. And the password, again, is Skyrocket. And the materials will be found under the first thread entitled the Skip IPG Conference Call Materials. The materials include an agenda outlining the call, the presentation slides for Dr. Bratzler's presentation, and an evaluation form that we're going to ask everyone to complete at the conclusion of the call. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Bratzler, who has been involved in healthcare quality improvement on the local, state, and national level since 1987, and at the Oklahoma Foundation for Medical Quality, he serves as the medical director for the Quality Improvement Organization Support Center for both the Medicare National Pneumonia Project as well as the SCIP project. And in these roles, he provides clinical and technical support for local and national quality improvement initiatives. I am pleased to welcome Dr. Dale Bratzler.
Good morning. Thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here, and what I hope to do today is provide an update to some of the activities that are going on around the National Surgical Care Improvement Project. I have had the opportunity to speak to many of you before, and I actually took a little time and looked back to see what I'd said the last time I spoke to you so that I made sure that today I would be really providing updates to the information about the Surgical Care Improvement Project. All of you should have been able to download my slides, and I'm going to try to run through some of those fairly quickly, mainly so that we have some time at the end of the call for questions, if you have any. I think all of you know that the Medicare program now is firmly committed to focusing on improving surgical quality. And if you look at the second slide, once again, I highlight information I think that all of you know. There are lots of operations performed in the United States each year. The Medicare program pays for lots of them. And despite the fact that both surgical care, surgical technique, perioperative care, anesthesia technique have all improved, we know that there are still substantial variations in outcomes of care for patients having surgery. It's well known, well documented in the literature, and we think that many of the events that happen to patients who have surgery are still preventable. So there's a real interest nationally in reducing bad perioperative outcomes and complications of surgery. And there have been a couple of recent papers that I just wanted to highlight that I think are really important. One was published by Justin Dimmick in 2004 in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. And he looked at the experience of the University of Michigan around the National Surgical Quality Improvement Project. Now, the University of Michigan is one of those private sector hospitals that's participating in the VA system of measuring quality for surgical care. And basically in their study, they found that on average, the cost of an infectious complication of surgery was about $1,400. The average cost of cardiac complication was almost $8,000. Respiratory complications, those are the patients that ended up with ventilator-associated pneumonia or ended up with a failure to wean from the ventilator, those were very expensive cases, up to $52,000 in additional cost to the hospital for a single case. And then thromboembolic complications, about $18,000 increased cost per case. So the costs to the individual hospital are very high when complications occur, and what he demonstrated here again, I think, is that you can quickly make a business case for reducing postoperative surgical complications. Shukri Curry earlier in 2005 published a paper that was looking at the VA's National Surgical Quality Improvement Project, and his colleagues and he demonstrated that independent of patient preoperative risk, the occurrence of one of these 30-day complications reduced median patient survival by 69%. And actually, I did not find this particularly surprising, since we had already reviewed in the past that we knew that infectious complications of surgery doubled patient mortality. So it wasn't surprising to me. But independent of the patient's risk, when a 30-day major complication occurs, it reduces median patient survival by 69%. On the next slide, who pays for surgical complications, I want to highlight this very interesting study that came from Dimmick and his colleagues, also with their work with the National Surgical Quality Improvement Project at the University of Michigan. So Dr. Dimmick was looking at the average hospital reimbursement and cost of care for surgical cases. And so if you look at the table at the top of the slide, it demonstrates that for an uncomplicated surgical case, the University of Michigan was paid on average about $14,266. It typically cost them just under $11,000 to care for the patient, so you can see that they made a profit on those cases, about a 23% profit margin for an uncomplicated surgical case. And certainly in most hospitals, surgery is a profit center. However, if the patient had a complication, interestingly, in our current payment system where we pay for volume of care and not necessarily for quality of care, the University of Michigan was paid more, on average about $21,911 per case. However, the cost of care went up substantially, and the profit margin was very small at about 3.4%, the profit margin for which, you know, from which most hospitals couldn't continue to survive. But the other point that Dimmick and his colleagues demonstrated was that the people that were paying the bills, the payers, always paid more for a complicated case. On average, their cost went up 54%. Again, remember, Medicare being the largest payer is clearly aware of this, that when patients have complications postoperatively, they always end up paying a larger bill. And what Dr. Dimmick and his colleagues were doing was trying to build a business case for quality improvement, not only from the hospital perspective, but also asking payers to fund some quality improvement activities locally that would help them reduce these complications, because the payers always ended up paying more when complications occurred. So moving on, I just wanted to repeat the national goal for the Surgical Care Improvement Project we've talked about before, to reduce preventable surgical morbidity and mortality by 25% by the year 2010. We put the word preventable in because we recognize that not all complications are preventable, and we do think that a 25% reduction in preventable complications is an achievable goal. So that's just a bit of background, some recent papers on the cost of care. Now let me just highlight any updates to the performance measures. I don't plan to spend a lot of time talking about the science behind the measures, but I just do want to cover some of the updates to the performance measures that you may or may not be aware of. So as you all remember, we started off with four prevention modules. The first module to prevent surgical infections, the second to prevent cardiac complications, the third to prevent venous thromboembolism, and then we had a fourth module, and that was to prevent respiratory complications, a module that we've now put completely on hold, and I'll explain why in a moment. So on the next slide, for the infection prevention module, here are the current performance measures that we are focusing on. You can collect data on all of these performance measures. These performance measures exist in Joint Commission vendor tools, and they also exist in the CMS CART tool. So the antibiotic measures are the same antibiotic measures that you've all seen before, antibiotics initiated within 1 hour before the incision, use of an antimicrobial recommended in guidelines, and discontinuation of antimicrobials within 24 hours of the surgery end or 48 hours if the patient has cardiac surgery. The three new measures include glucose control in cardiac surgery patients, proper hair removal, and normothermia in colorectal surgery patients. I did want to highlight that the three antibiotic measures are all endorsed by the National Quality Forum. That's important to know because that means that once they've been endorsed by the National Quality Forum, then they are eligible for public reporting by the Hospital Quality Alliance. The final three measures, glucose control, hair removal, and normothermia, are currently undergoing consensus review by the National Quality Forum. They are not yet endorsed by the NQF, and therefore they will not be used for any accountability activities such as publication on the Hospital Quality Alliance website or Hospital Compare at this time. So just to highlight, I want to spend a few moments highlighting the three antibiotic measures again just to give you the updates on the three measures, mainly because these three are NQF endorsed, which means that they will be tied to public reporting, and many of you know that the first and the third of these measures, you're already required to submit publicly report to the Hospital Quality Alliance for publication on Hospital Compare for the annual payment update effective for July 2006 discharges. So let me just highlight the measures. Once again, they are, again, the proportion of patients with antibiotics initiated within an hour, getting an antibiotic consistent with current recommendations, and the proportion of antibiotics that are discontinued within 24 hours of surgery end time. That's raised a lot of questions. I'll just highlight right off the bat that there's no controversy about the first performance measure, about initiating the antibiotic dose within 1 hour before the incision. Remember, you have 120 minutes to initiate the antibiotic if you use drugs such as a fluoroquinolone or vancomycin. But really, there's no current controversy about the first performance measure, and we have no plans at this point in altering that performance measure. I did want to highlight the other two measures just to make a couple of points. I get lots of questions about the use of vancomycin for prophylaxis. And the typical email that comes to me is, you know, our hospital antibiogram demonstrates that 50% of the strains of Staph aureus in our hospital are due to methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or sometimes the proportion is even higher. And I think there are a couple of things that you need to think about when you start talking about the use of vancomycin for prophylaxis. The first one is that the hospital antibiogram, although a very, very useful tool for thinking about antibiotic therapy in your hospital, represents a frequency count of the organisms and the antibiotic susceptibility patterns within your hospital for all those cultures that are done. So antibiograms tend to be biased oftentimes to the sickest patients in your hospital who have lots of cultures, and those oftentimes represent patients in the ICU. So if you're going to make decisions about antibiotic selection for surgical prophylaxis, then use data on surgical site infection surveillance rather than just sticking to the antibiogram, because sometimes it doesn't reflect necessarily the same organisms that you'll see in surgical site infections. On the next slide, you see a pie graph, and I just wanted to highlight, this is data from the CDC. I may have showed it to you before, but it's very, very important because, once again, this is the pathogens that cause the bad infections, deep surgical site infections following coronary artery bypass surgery and hip and knee arthroplasty. So these are the patients with the chest that's left open in the ICU, or the patients that have to have removal of their prosthetic because it's infected. Well, about 40% of those are due to Staph aureus, half of which are typically methicillin resistant. About 15% are due to coag-negative Staph aureus. But an important point, 20% of the infections reported to CDC are due to gram-negative bacteria. And if you have a tendency to want to use vancomycin for surgical prophylaxis, vancomycin will provide absolutely no protection against gram-negative infections. So that's an important point to remember when you think about the surveillance of organisms that are causing surgical site infections. The second point I'd like to make about vancomycin on the next slide is that in studies that have compared vancomycin to beta-lactams for prevention of surgical site infections, particularly after cardiac surgery, the infection rates typically are actually higher in patients who get vancomycin than they are in patients who get a beta-lactam for prophylaxis. Now, while it is true that patients that get vancomycin are less likely to have a methicillin-resistant Staph aureus infection, they're more likely to have infection with other organisms, such as methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, gram-negatives, or other organisms that are not prevented by vancomycin. Vancomycin is not a great drug for prophylaxis because of its long infusion time, the complications associated with infusion, the fact that it is fairly slow at tissue penetration, and the fact that it provides no coverage for organisms other than gram-positive organisms. So think about that before you pull out vancomycin for prophylaxis. On the next slide, I just highlighted that on a joint memo that we, CMS and Joint Commission just sent out to hospitals. I would point out that we have modified now the antibiotics in the list of those recommended for prophylaxis for skip infection 2, that antibiotic measure. And so skip infection 2 reporting now is available for voluntary reporting effective for July discharges of this year. And on the next two slides, you see the recently updated antibiotic recommendations. So the antibiotic recommendations for hip and knee arthroplasty or cardiac and vascular surgery are similar. The preferred agents are cefazolin or cefuroxime. In the United States, by far, cefazolin is the most commonly used drug. For those patients with beta-lactam allergy, the use of vancomycin or clindamycin, depending on your hospital's antibiotic susceptibility patterns, are useful for prophylaxis. And if the patient has a high risk for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and that's documented in the chart, then you may use vancomycin for prophylaxis. So we've liberalized the ability to use vancomycin for prophylaxis. We do recommend, however, that there be a patient-level assessment of risk for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So I would highlight that the patient that comes into the hospital for elective arthroplasty surgery who's not been in the healthcare setting before, has no other risk factors for MRSA, is at quite low risk of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, as compared to the patient who happens to be in a nursing home, falls down, breaks a hip. That patient's at much greater risk. So there are well-defined risk factors for MRSA, and clearly we do agree that it's appropriate to use vancomycin for prophylaxis for some patients. However, there should be some patient-level assessment of risk for MRSA before you decide to use vancomycin. We just recently profiled hospitals around the country on use of vancomycin, and for all operations in vascular, cardiac, and orthopedic surgery, about 8% of operations have vancomycin used for prophylaxis. One other point I wanted to make. There is a new guideline for surgical prophylaxis antibiotic selection coming out from the Society of Thoracic Surgery. It's not published yet. It will be published soon in Annals of Thoracic Surgery. And in that guideline, we recommend that when you make the decision to use vancomycin for prophylaxis because you're concerned about risk factors for MRSA, that vancomycin should never be used alone for prophylaxis. It provides no gram-negative protection. Infection rates tend to be higher. So in the guideline, we actually recommend that if you're concerned about MRSA, that you give vancomycin along with a dose of cefazolin. If the patient's allergic to beta-lactams, we recommend the use of vancomycin plus gentamicin. Or if the patient has a beta-lactam allergy and renal insufficiency, we would recommend one or two doses of vancomycin plus a single dose of levofloxacin. So that guideline will be coming out soon. It just, again, highlights the fact that vancomycin is not a very good drug for prophylaxis and provides no gram-negative protection. On the next slide, you see the recommendations for hysterectomy and colorectal surgery. We of course, understand and know that cefotetin is not currently available in the United States. We have heard rumors that it may get picked up by a generic manufacturer again, but I can't confirm that at this point. Clearly, in the United States, for hysterectomy, cefazolin is by far the most commonly used drug for prophylaxis, and we recently added ampicillin sulbactam to the list of appropriate antibiotics. For colorectal surgery, the available drugs include suboxone, cefazolin plus metronidazole, or we recently added ampicillin sulbactam to the list of appropriate drugs for surgical prophylaxis. So that's how the measure has been modified. Once again, just to highlight one more time at the end here, should vancomycin ever be used alone for surgical prophylaxis? I just mentioned that in upcoming guidelines from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, and also in an upcoming guideline being published by the Medical Letter in December, you will see that there is a suggestion that you consider using a second antibiotic anytime that vancomycin is used for surgical prophylaxis. Also, remember that vancomycin, when used for prophylaxis, should always be limited to one and no more than two doses. What about discontinuation of prophylaxis, the third performance measure? We've made no recommendations to change the measure at all. We still recommend that antibiotics be discontinued within 24 hours, and that's within. That does not mean you have to give three or two doses of antibiotics postoperatively, because there are many, many studies that single-dose prophylaxis is acceptable for prevention of surgical site infections. I would highlight, though, that I believe that prolonged surgical antibiotic prophylaxis has become a patient safety issue. And there are growing concerns around the country about outbreaks of Clostridium difficile enterocolitis. Now, I recognize that sometimes C. difficile enterocolitis occurs in the community, but there was a very nice recent review of C. difficile infections by Dr. John Bartlett. And in that review, he highlights that many of the patients who develop C. difficile enterocolitis have been treated with prolonged antibiotics or have recently received antibiotic therapy. I think all of you know that, but I think there's increasing concerns because the recent strains that have been causing infection in patients have been very virulent, resulting in rapid need for surgery, major surgery, such as total colectomy, to save the patient's life. So prolonged prophylaxis has become a patient safety issue. And I also wanted to highlight on the next slide a paper that was just published in Archives of Surgery here just a month or so ago, looking at single-dose antibiotic prophylaxis for prevention of surgical site infections. This particular study came out of Brazil. Interestingly, the study was focusing primarily on cost savings of single-dose prophylaxis. But in the study, very large study, 12,000 patients, about 6,000 in the multi-dose arm and about 6,000 in the single-dose arm. The primary criticism of the study was that for some of the patients, they did not have complete 30-day follow-up, although the lack of complete follow-up was pretty equally divided between the multi-dose group and the single-dose group. Their summary was that one-dose antibiotic prophylaxis did not lead to increased rates of surgical site infection, and it saved money. Just considering cefazolin alone, this particular institution saved about $2,000 per month by giving single-dose prophylaxis. Now, and if you look at the study, they looked at a wide variety of surgeries, general surgeries, orthopedic surgery, cardiac and vascular surgery, and essentially showed no difference in the infection rates between the two groups of patients. So this study, to me, is simply consistent with all of the other studies that have been published that shows that when you compare single-dose prophylaxis to multi-dose prophylaxis, there's no difference in the infection rate. You're not doing anything to reduce the surgical site infection rate. All you do by giving extra doses of antibiotics is increase cost, potentially patient safety issues with C. difficile, and potentially increasing the risk of a patient when they do get an infection of having a resistant organism. So another good study I'd recommend that you at least take a look at. Well, let me just tell you about some of the national surveillance data that we have on antibiotic prophylaxis. Dr. David Hunt, my colleague at CMS, recently highlighted that CMS is the 800-pound gorilla. And I think it shows when you look at the next slide, which is the bar graph demonstrating the number of voluntary reporting hospitals for those antibiotic measures. Back in the third quarter of 2002, we had 30 hospitals nationwide that voluntarily submitted their antibiotic data for these measures. And you can see that number has consistently grown. At the end of 2005, there were 1,700 hospitals that were voluntarily reporting the data on those three antibiotic measures. At the end of 2004, there were 70 hospitals in New York State that were voluntarily reporting that data. I find it very interesting, though, that the recently published inpatient prospective payment system rule that requires reporting these measures starting for July discharges, not not the first quarter of 2006, but the third quarter of 2006, has apparently motivated a lot of hospitals to still go ahead and start collecting and reporting the data, because in the first quarter of 2006, we saw almost double the number, up to 3,247 hospitals now that are voluntarily, there's no payment tied to reporting these measures, but 3,200 hospitals reported more than 200,000 cases to our data set, and the number in New York State jumped from 70 to 173 hospitals that were voluntarily reporting for the first quarter of 2006. So a marked increase in reporting. On the next slide, you see line graphs. This is independently abstracted data by the CMS. This is not the voluntary data that hospitals submit. And you can see that we've seen steady improvement in most of the performance measures. So when we started the project back in 2001, about 41% of the patients had their antibiotics stopped within 24 hours of the end of surgery. In the third quarter of 2005, that number was up to 62%. We saw a marked increase in the number of patients that had antibiotics administered within the hour before the incision. And, of course, rates of prophylaxis consistent with guidelines were quite high from the start and really had not changed hardly at all. So we've seen improvement in these national performance measures. When I focus on the data only from the hospitals that are voluntarily submitting data, those 3,247 hospitals on the next slide, you can see what the national averages are, the benchmark performance, and also the rates for the 173 New York hospitals that are voluntarily reporting. So in New York State, the hospitals that are voluntarily reporting, about 82% of the time the antibiotic started within the hour, 91% of the time a guideline-recommended antibiotic is administered, and about 73% of the time antibiotics are discontinued within 24 hours of the end of surgery. This does include 48 hours for cardiac surgery. The benchmarks, however, when I take all hospitals that report, all 3,247, rank them from best to worst, I count down the list of the hospitals at the top that cared for 10% of the population. Remember, I said there were about 200,000 cases submitted, so I count down the list of hospitals at the top that cared for somewhere around 20,000 patients and averaged their performance. The benchmark hospitals, the average performance of the best hospitals here was that 97% of the time they gave the antibiotic, initiated it within the hour, almost always gave a guideline-recommended antibiotic, and about 96% of the time stopped antibiotics within 24 hours of the end of surgery. So dramatic improvements in the quality of care since we first started the project in 2001. So to end the conversation about antibiotics, one slide I always like to show when I talk to individuals about antibiotic prophylaxis, there are four antibiotic prophylaxis practices that have been shown to prevent surgical site infections. The first one is administration of the antibiotic dose just before the incision. The second one is appropriate selection of the antibiotic, picking an antibiotic that is appropriate for the common organisms to be encountered. The third one is adjusting the dose based on the patient's weight. Remember that a big patient needs a big dose. And finally, the fourth practice that has clearly been shown to reduce surgical site infection rates is redosing the patient in the operating room when you have a long operation. Remember, you need antibiotic in the wound the entire time the wound is open. So if you have a long case and you give a short-acting antibiotic like cefazolin, many times within 3 to 4 hours of the initial dose, the patient needs to receive another dose in the operating room. These four practices have been shown to reduce the risk of surgical site infections. Let me move on to the cardiac complication prevention module. Some changes perhaps since I last talked to you. We now only have one performance measure, and that is perioperative beta blockers in patients who are on beta blockers prior to admission. So the only group of patients that we're currently looking at are those patients who are taking beta blockers chronically before admission to the hospital. The data is very clear here that these patients should not have their antibiotics discontinued. I would also highlight that that particular performance measure is undergoing review by the National Quality Forum. It is not yet endorsed, so it won't be used for public reporting, at least in the immediate future. This particular performance measure is based on the updated ACC AHA guideline that was just published. Lee Flesher, who chaired the committee, actually is on the steering committee for the Surgical Care Improvement Project. And as we started talking about the beta blocker measures, he felt it was important that he get together a guideline committee to review the literature. And it was published. And basically, if you look on the next slide, under the ACC-AHA guideline for perioperative beta blockers, there are two Class 1 recommendations for use of beta blockers for patients having surgery. The first one is in those patients who are undergoing surgery, who are receiving beta blockers chronically to treat angina, symptomatic arrhythmias, hypertension, or any other ACC-AHA Class 1 guideline indication. The second is beta blockers should be given to patients undergoing vascular surgery at high cardiac risk owing to the finding of ischemia on preoperative testing. Because it's so difficult for us to identify ischemia on preoperative testing based on chart review, we do not have a performance measure for the second of the Class 1 recommendations. So we currently have one performance measure, and that is those patients chronically on beta blockers before arrival should have them continued at the time of surgery. I just recently spoke with Lee Flesher, and he pointed out that even newer data now, since their guideline came out, continues to show that stopping beta blockers in patients who take them chronically is a bad thing to do when a patient's having surgery. The next module is on venous thromboembolism prevention. I think this one's extremely important. Updated information from John Height and his group at the Mayo Clinic have demonstrated that VTE may be much, much more common than we originally thought. They now estimate, based on their epidemiologic survey from Olmsted County, that more than 900,000 Americans may suffer VTE each year, with about 500,000 of those being pulmonary embolism cases, and that PE may prove fatal in about 300,000 cases a year. That would make it the most common cause of death in the United States, more so than a myocardial infarction, and the third most common cause of hospital-related death in the United States. Indeed, many of those patients who have sudden death after they leave the hospital or others may be dying from pulmonary embolia, not myocardial death. If you look at recommendations from national bodies, LeapFrog considers pulmonary embolism to be the most common preventable cause of hospital death in the United States. I think that's really important, the most common preventable cause of hospital death in the United States. You may remember a few years ago, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality ranked patient safety practices and ranked thromboprophylaxis as the number one patient safety practice. And then the American Public Health Association highlighted the fact that despite the fact that we know that VTE is so common in hospitalized patients, we know how to prevent it, the fact that we don't execute by giving DVT prophylaxis represents a public health crisis. On the next slide, I highlight, remember, the most important acquired risk factor for VTE is hospitalization. Patients in the hospital are at much, much greater risk of VTE than patients in the community setting. John Hyde and his group at the Mayo Clinic demonstrated that the risk of VTE in a hospitalized patient is about 100 times greater than a similar patient in the community setting. So every patient walking into the door of the hospital has one risk factor for VTE. And on the next slide, I simply highlight that if you look at the patient population, particularly in med-surg floors, almost all of them have at least one additional risk factor for VTE. And so I would ask the question, should VTE prophylaxis be the default for all hospitalized patients, with risk assessment used to identify those patients who don't need VTE prophylaxis? And I can tell you that today on most med-surg floors, very few patients shouldn't be on VTE prophylaxis. Despite the fact that we know VTE is very common in hospitalized patients, prophylaxis use is nowhere near what it should be. On the slide with the table that's thromboprophylaxis use in practice from 1992 to 2002, this is just a summary slide of various chart audits that have actually looked at use of VTE prophylaxis. And we know that orthopedic surgeons tend to use it very well, although it not always consistent with at least the published recommendations. They do tend to use prophylaxis consistently. General surgery, about 30% of cases don't get it. About 30% or so of critical care patients don't get VTE prophylaxis. And the worst performers were those medical patients not having surgery, where rates of prophylaxis use have been very low consistently in published audits. So we have two national performance measures. The first one is the proportion of patients who have recommended VTE prophylaxis ordered. The second one is proportion of patients who receive an appropriate form of VTE prophylaxis based on the ACCP consensus recommendations within 24 hours before or after surgery. I would highlight that both of these performance measures have gone through the NQF process. They are endorsed. They will be publicly reported soon. So again, I ask, should VTE prophylaxis be the default for hospitalized patients? Many of us believe that it should. And when you do risk assessment, if you decide to do formal risk assessment of a patient admitted to the hospital, the vast majority of patients will have risk factors for VTE. Everybody has one. They're in the hospital. The question is, do they have a second one? Because if they have more than one, they should certainly receive VTE prophylaxis. And there are a variety of strategies to improve use of VTE prophylaxis. One is to use preprinted protocols. Another one is the study that was published on electronic alerts to prevent VTE among hospitalized patients, Sam Goldhaber and his group at Boston. Used an electronic alert system in their computer system to remind the attending physician to order VTE prophylaxis. So they had about 1,200 patients in each group. Interestingly, I personally think that their intervention was not very successful. They went from use of prophylaxis of 15% in the control group only up to 34% in the alert group. Now, that was a doubling. But what was interesting, they had objective follow-up of all the patients at 90 days with compression ultrasound to demonstrate whether or not the patients had VTE or not. And they saw almost a 50% reduction in the rates of VTE just with the simple electronic alert system, doubling the rate of VTE prophylaxis. Again, leapfrog cause VTE, the number one preventable cause of hospital death. So the results of their study basically were that the electronic alerts improved the use of prophylaxis by 130%, reduced symptomatic VTE by 41%, and they saw no increased risk of bleeding in the patients who got VTE prophylaxis. Clearly, it's underutilized. We need to do better jobs of giving VTE prophylaxis. Finally, before I stop talking about VTE, I'd just highlight that the National Quality Forum, in somewhat of a departure from their usual activities of simply endorsing performance measure, actually received an unrestricted grant to build national performance standards for prevention and care of VTE. And they've subcontracted part of the work to the Joint Commission. I have the honor of co-chairing one of the technical advisory panels that's actually focused on building the performance measures. And on the next slide, you can see that we currently have 8 performance measures that are undergoing pilot testing with a group of hospitals around the country. We hope to have the final set of performance measures back to the steering committee at the National Quality Forum for endorsement in 2008. So just to highlight, we have performance measures on risk assessment prophylaxis. We have measures on treatment and measures on one measure on outcome. So for risk assessment and prophylaxis, what proportion of patients have a risk assessment or receive prophylaxis within 24 hours of hospital admission? And by the way, to pass the measure, if the risk assessment suggests need, then the patient has to receive prophylaxis. Similarly, any patient transferred to the intensive care unit should be reassessed for need for prophylaxis. For treatment, we have performance measures reflecting whether or not there's documentation of indications for the use of inferior vena cava filters. We see lots of them being used with almost no data to support their use, particularly for prevention of VTE. VTE patients with overlap therapy. If a patient started on warfarin, they need to continue parenteral therapy for at least 4 days to make sure they're fully anticoagulated. Routine platelet count monitoring in patients on unfractionated heparin, use of nomograms or protocols in patients on unfractionated heparin, and VTE discharge instructions, since transitions of care are areas for frequent handoff failures. And then finally, what is the incidence of potentially preventable hospital-acquired VTE? Looking at incident cases of VTE in the hospitalized patient, how often do we find out whether or not they were on VTE prophylaxis before the event occurred? So these are the eight measures that are currently undergoing pilot testing by the Joint Commission with a group of hospitals that volunteered to participate. Let me just mention the respiratory complication bundle. Prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia is a part of the IHI's 100,000 Lives campaign. Many hospitals around the country implemented the ventilator bundle, and it included typically some combination of things, which included elevation of the head of the bed to 30 degrees, portion of patients put on a rapid weaning protocol, which might include daily sedation vacations or assessments of readiness to wean, proportion of ventilator patients who receive stress ulcer prophylaxis, and then the fourth one in the bundle was use of VTE prophylaxis. We actually have put this module on hold for a couple of reasons. The first one is that there was a recognition that this respiratory bundle was only going to apply to patients who were in the ICU postoperatively on the ventilator. And there are many other patients who are in the intensive care unit receiving care, or patients in the ICU on ventilators that probably should be assessed also for performance, for quality improvement opportunities, but we were only going to get at a very, very small proportion of the patients in the ICU with this particular measure. On the next slide, I also highlight a study that was published earlier this year in Critical Care Medicine on both the feasibilities and the effects of a semi-recumbent position to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia. This was a nice randomized study of a little bit more than 200 patients from Europe. They randomized patients to either elevation of the head of the bed to 45 degrees or elevation of the head of the bed to 10 degrees. Well, they found a couple of things. First, they couldn't achieve 45 degrees. They actually had computerized monitors on the bed to actually measure where the head of the bed was actually set and how often it was laid back down flat. And so they achieved 28 degrees, which is awfully close to 30 degrees, versus the other group, which was able to stay at 10 degrees pretty well. But the second thing they demonstrated was that elevation of the head of the bed, when they controlled for all the other factors, did not prevent the development of ventilator-associated pneumonia. And so we don't think that performance measure could get NQF endorsement based on this study. It's really of some concern to us that the strength of evidence to support some aspects of the bundle is there. Now, I know many of you are aware that there are many anecdotal reports from around the country of prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia with implementation of the ventilator bundle, and perhaps it works. Perhaps the interaction of all the aspects of the bundle work. But at least in this particular study, elevation of the head of the bed alone did not work, and so we have elected not to move this particular performance measure forward. Well, let me end by talking a little bit about public accountability and SCIP. I think all of you know that in 2003, the Medicare Modernization Act, Congress spelled out 10 measures that all hospitals would voluntarily submit, and I highlight that it actually does say that reporting of the measures is voluntary. However, if a hospital did not voluntarily report those 10 measures, they would lose 0.4% of their Medicare annual payment update. Indeed, 98.3% of all eligible hospitals in the United States reported 10 measures of quality to make sure they got that 0.4% of their Medicare annual payment update. Well, now Congress is up the ante. The Deficit Reduction Act, passed in 2005, signed by President Bush, and then implemented by CMS through rules, basically expands the number of measures that hospitals must submit, and effective for discharges of July 2006, hospitals are voluntarily again asked to report 21 measures of care, 8 for acute myocardial infarction, 7 for pneumonia, 4 for heart failure, and 2 of the surgical infection measures, 2 of the antibiotic measures. though reporting, once again, is still voluntary, failure to report results in loss of 2% of the Medicare annual payment update. I would highlight again that CMS didn't make this stuff up. Congress required them to do so, and Congress set the 2% payment differential. The second point that you may or may not be familiar with in the Deficit Reduction Act is Congress directed the Department of Health and Human Services, the Secretary, basically to begin phasing out payment increases associated with complications of care. So remember who pays for surgical complications from the slide I showed you from Justin Dimmick at the first of the presentation. The payer always pays more. And so when patients have complications, not only their higher cost at the hospital level, but clearly those paying the bills end up paying more. So Congress has directed CMS to figure out ways to start paying for to stop paying for complications. Now, I don't know how this is going to be done yet. I think this is complicated because all of us recognize that not all complications that occur are preventable. Even with the best care, some complications will occur. I would surmise, and this would be my opinion only, that CMS will try to identify some complications that are fairly typically preventable and figure out ways to not pay for those. So an example might be bloodstream infections. Bloodstream infections, device-related bloodstream infections, are often preventable. There's pretty good data that with proper care, you can prevent most bloodstream infections. Now, I admit that some of them may not be preventable, and no system that CMS is able to devise is going to be perfect. But I think that look for them to figure out ways to identify those complications that are usually preventable, and those are the types of things that at least initially they will figure out how to phase out payment for. Finally, in terms of accountability, the outpatient prospective payment system rule was published on November 1st, and effective for January discharges, it expands the number of measures that hospitals must report. So they must report the 21 current measures, and it adds three more measures that hospitals must collect and report to continue to receive the 2% annual payment update. Skip infection 2, which is antibiotic selection, and then the two VTE measures. Now, I would highlight that all of the measures that show up in any of these rules are ones that are NQF endorsed, and that's why you don't see the cardiac measure, you don't see hair removal, normothermia, or glucose control yet because they've not gone through the NQF process. But the antibiotic selection measure and the two VT measures are NQF endorsed, and they are tied to payment for reporting beginning with January discharges. Also, in the Deficit Reduction Act, Congress mandated that the Secretary develop a plan to implement value-based purchasing. Value-based purchasing is kind of the code name for pay-for-performance based on the expanded measure set. So beginning in fiscal year 2009, CMS must begin paying for performance based on some subset of this expanded measure set. So I think it's very likely that you'll look at the 24 measures of the data that you're submitting. Some subset of those measures will be selected to use for pay-for-performance for hospitals beginning in 2008. So not only will you be getting paid for whether or not you report the data, but the actual performance rates on the data will begin to matter starting in 2008, and it will impact your hospital payment. Well, I threw in some preliminary skip data, the bar graphs that you see. This is national data from the first quarter of 2005. It's not a truly random national sample of Medicare patients. It's a bit overrepresentative of hospitals like your own that are a part of an identified participant group for QIOs around the country. But just to highlight that there are substantial opportunities still to improve the quality of care on some of these measures. So antibiotics within an hour, we're up to 67%. That's about 10% better than we were in 2001, but still a long ways to go. 76% in New York for antibiotic selection. That reflects, I think, some of the antibiotic shortages that have occurred. 55% for antibiotics stopped within 24 hours. glucose control, 85% New York State, 95% hair removal. So most of the time in New York, you don't use razors. 61% of the time, patients are kept warm in the operating room. VTE prophylaxis, New York looked better than the average. About 82% of the time, recommended prophylaxis ordered, and 77% of the time, recommended prophylaxis actually given to the patient within 24 hours before or after surgery. But clearly, still opportunities for improving the quality of care. Just a couple of final notes. We have made some abstraction changes to the performance measures. I just want to highlight, effective next April, we've built an exclusion into the antibiotic measures for penetrating abdominal trauma, so that if the patient has actual gunshot wound or stabbing or true penetrating trauma, the case will be excluded from the antibiotic measures. We've also added synonyms for infection, like necrotic or infarcted bowel, gangrene, lung infiltrates. Any of those will be acceptable synonyms for infection, which will exclude the case from the antibiotic measures. We are also building in an exclusion for PRN beta blockers. One of the things that came up is that we occasionally run across patients who come into the hospital that are taking PRN beta blockers. I'm not exactly sure what PRN beta blockers would be being used for, perhaps migraine or other things, and so those cases will be excluded. Patients having neuraxial anesthesia will pass the VTE measures if either pharmacologic or mechanical prophylaxis are used beginning with April discharges. So that basically acknowledges that neuraxial anesthesia is not an absolute contraindication to pharmacologic prophylaxis. And, in fact, I would commend Dr. Stimmer, who noted one of the problems with that measure. And then minor procedure codes are being removed from the list. When the original list of operations were put together for sampling, some codes got in for some minor operations like paracentesis and others, and all of those are being removed. And anything being performed exclusively by laparoscopy are being excluded from the performance measures. The final note I'd like to point out is that we need better measures. Right now, all the work that we're doing around the CMS quality initiatives is focused on process measures. We are starting to get some outcome measures, particularly focusing on mortality. We are working with some researchers around the country to see if we can start to identify risk-adjusted surgical outcomes that we might use for measurement of hospital performance. But clearly, there have been a number of articles recently that highlighted we still have opportunities and need to improve our performance measurement ability. We do look at all these process measures. They do all go through the NQF process. If they're not endorsed, some of them will be dropped, and we are looking for new measures that provide a better measure of hospital quality. Lastly, we just recently had the consumer rollout, Tips for Safer Surgery. It's available on our website. We rolled this out. Secretary Mike Leavitt actually introduced this at a press conference in Washington, D.C. that was moderated by Carolyn Clancy with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. The meeting was well represented by groups such as AARP and the Center for Women and Children and other consumer groups. So you're going to see a lot more about the SCIP project coming out in consumer publications as this the Tips for Safer Surgery and other activities are promoted to consumer groups. So I'm going to stop there, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. It's been my pleasure to be here, and if you have any information or need anything, let me know.
Thank you, Dr. Bratzler. Devin, can we open up the lines for any of our audience that may have questions, please?
Yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question comes from Janine Woltman of Glen Cove Hospital.
Good morning, and that was an excellent presentation. I do have one question regarding the beta blockers. It's my understanding that the beta blocker has to be given within 24 hours of incision time. Is that correct?
Yes, within 24 hours before the incision, up through the time the patient until they're discharged from the recovery area. So so you have a fairly long window. So if the patient takes their home dose the evening before surgery, that passes. If they take it with a small sip of water on the morning of surgery, that will pass the performance measure.
Okay, because that's what we're doing.
Yeah, it does not have to be administered in the hospital.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chris Porter of Bassett Healthcare.
Hi, this is actually Evelyn Kropp, a partner of Chris's. You were talking about the need for better outcomes measurements, and there's been some talk of cooperation between the NSQIP and the SCIP program. Can you tell us where things are at with that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's come up in a lot of conversations. We meet with the representatives from the VA all the time. And we've had lots of meetings with QC Metrics, the vendor that actually produces the data collection tool for NISQIP. They are supposedly in the process of incorporating all of the SCIP process measures into the NISQIP data collection tool. So VA is fully committed to incorporating the SCIP measures into the VA system, which would include putting all of these measures into their data collection and also then into the data collection in the private sector NSQIP that's been rolled out through the American College of Surgeons. So I don't know the timeline, but those conversations are certainly ongoing, and we have every intention of making sure that they have the process measures in their tools.
Well, what they're telling us is that the delay is coming about from an agreement on whether the patients that are included in the NSQIP will meet criteria for SCIP.
And so perhaps it's a question about the sampling. I'm not a part of those conversations, but I'll see if I can follow up and get information to IPRO and let you know.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joel, excuse me if I pronounce this wrong, Yohai of Catholic Health Services.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Thank you very much for the presentation. Do you have a discharge date yet for when the VTE 1 and 2 measures will be required? That is, which discharges starting when?
Well, there are, okay, so VTE 1 and 2 are out there for data collection tools that came out for October discharges, but they are tied to public reporting for January 2007 discharges. So according to the outpatient prospective payment system rule, effective with January 2007 discharges, to continue to receive the full 2% Medicare payment update, you must report the 21 measures plus the three that have been added, the antibiotic selection measure and the two VTE measures. So it's for discharges that begin in January.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from Cindy Pigno of St. Charles Hospital.
Thank you. I'm calling on behalf of Cindy Pigno at St. Charles Hospital. This is a question, and this is represented actually on your high-impact change strategy assessment form. Do you designate or are there statistical performance improvement measures that show any difference between assessment and designation for somebody like anesthesia or perioperative personnel giving the pre-op antibiotic dose as opposed to the floor nurse?
Well, so the biggest problem typically with the antibiotic being initiated by the floor nurse is that it typically will be well before the incision is made. Now, I don't know how you're defining the floor nurse. If you mean the circulating nurse, I just gave a presentation day before yesterday in Anaheim to a large group of hospital system pharmacists, and they highlighted that in some institutions, circulating nurses start the antibiotics. In some institutions, anesthesia starts the antibiotics. Interestingly, the American Society of Anesthesiology has been working with the AMA Physicians Consortium to build a physician-level performance measure that would hold the anesthesiologist accountable for this measure of ensuring that the antibiotic was initiated within the hour before the incision. That said, I think you can do it either way. But if it's actually the floor nurse before the patient comes down to the operating room, clearly the data show that when the antibiotics are administered more than an hour before the incision, the infection rates go up. They go way up once it gets to be more than 2 hours before the incision. So.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from Susan Parker of One Chip University.
We have a certain number of our patients being discharged and having had received appropriate VTE prophylaxis, but then they come back in with DVTs and PEs, and the assumption, I think, is that we feel that they're going to be ambulating well enough at home so that they don't require anything further. If this should continue, do you think there may be some rationale in the future for continuing VTE prophylaxis after their discharge and that becoming part of the measure?
That's a good question. You know, in fact, I sent a note to John Hyde at the Mayo Clinic yesterday asking him about what proportion of VTE cases do you think are preventable if we gave universal, you know, if we really were good at giving VTE prophylaxis, because I think there is fairly good data that some patients, even with prophylaxis, will continue to have VTE. You know, there's pretty good data in the hip surgery population that continuing prophylaxis after hospital discharge reduces the rates of VTE. I don't know that we have good data for other types of operations. So at this point in time, we don't have any performance measures there. We actually did consider performance measures for evaluating long-term prophylaxis in patients who had major hip surgery, but frankly, the data source for us would just simply not be there, so we had to drop it in our evaluation. I think it's a great question. I think it's open for research, but until there's good, clear data that continuing prophylaxis in the ambulatory setting is going to reduce the incidence of VTE, we probably won't have a performance measure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. Once again, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone.
Hi, Dr. Bratzer. This is Dr. Stimler. I have one or two questions. I wanted to thank you also very much personally for this excellent presentation that you've provided for us, which is, I think, going to be extremely valuable for all the hospitals on the line. I had another question that follows up Dr. Yohai's question on the OPPS rule. You pointed out that skip infection 2, VTE 1 and 2 are essentially kicking in for January 07. To be required for the update. What about the HCAPs and the CMS 30-day mortality measures that are on the same slide? When is the expected dates for those to be?
You know, that's a good question, Charles, and I'm not exactly sure. I believe that what I've been told is that HCAPs was to start somewhere around July of 07, and I'm not sure the exact timeline. I know there's going to be in the near future a dry run where all hospitals will get to see their 30-day mortality measures for AMI heart failure and then eventually for pneumonia. Those performance measures are calculated from your Medicare claims data. They don't require any data collection on your part. But I don't know the exact timeline of those. I know that I don't believe, though, they start in January.
Okay, thanks. I have another maybe more arcane or picky question, but it goes to the pilot testing measures that JCO is working on for VTE. I noticed one of them is in the treatment talking about the use of a nomogram or protocol for unfractionated heparin. And I'm curious at the nomogram / protocol terminology. I'm sure you're aware of the article that came out in JAMA a few months ago, I think it was, or perhaps last month, looking at fixed dose unfractionated heparin, or actually it was not so much fixed, but I think it was based on weight. Fixed based on weight, and apparently it was one study from Canada that seemed to show that one could, you know, just use a fixed weighted dose. Is that observation How is that observation involved in this measure? Is there any discussion of it?
Yeah, absolutely. We did talk about that study a lot. So it was a very good study, looked at using very concentrated high doses of subcutaneous unfractionated heparin for acute treatment of VTE. It showed it to be quite effective. So the performance measure that we're pilot testing will only focus on those that are receiving parenteral intravenous infusions of unfractionated heparin, which surprisingly is still used more than you might think in this era of lots of use of low molecular weight heparins. Lots of patients having operations, procedures, and others are still getting unfractionated heparin infusions. So the question is, for those patients getting unfractionated heparin infusions, is it being administered via some protocol or normogram? But we actually did have to modify a couple of the measures specifically in reference to the use of the high-dose concentrated sub-Q unfractionated heparin.
Thanks very much.
We have a question from Cindy Pena's line.
Yes, this is Dr. Neil Kurtz at St. Charles Hospital. I have a question regarding the proposed performance measures for VTE prophylaxis. Will it be satisfactory to use mechanoprophylaxis and warfarin, or are we looking towards having all patients on some form of parenteral therapy or unfractionated heparin as an initial treatment until warfarin kicks in?
Yeah, so it'll depend on the operation. We have a table that's in the hospital manual that spells out all of the grade A recommendations from the ACCP for different forms of prophylaxis based on the type of operation. So, for instance, for total knee arthroplasty, mechanical prophylaxis alone is one of the grade A recommendations, and mechanical prophylaxis alone for total knee arthroplasty will pass the performance measure. For hip surgeries, hip fracture, and total hip prosthesis, those particular operations, mechanical prophylaxis alone is not recommended, and pharmacologic prophylaxis is always recommended in those patients unless there's a documented bleeding risk. So for all the performance measures, we built in a physician documentation for any bleeding risk, and we don't try to define that. We leave that up to the discretion of the physician to define. But if you document that the patient has a bleeding risk, then mechanical forms of prophylaxis will be considered acceptable. And I also mentioned any patient that gets neuraxial anesthesia, whether it's, you know, actually for anesthesia or epidural for pain management, those cases also mechanical prophylaxis alone will pass the performance measure.
So in general, the all the Category 1 ACCP recommendations will be compliant in the future. Is that right?
Yes. So we went with all the grade A recommendations from the ACCP.
Thank you.
We also have another question.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
One moment.
Oh.
Antibiotic selection or VTE prophylaxis in regard to bariatric surgery, are there any guidelines out there for weight-based when you get beyond the charts that are normally published now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not aware of any specific guidelines. That's another one, though, that I'll see if I can get some research and get some information to iPro to send out on dose adjustment, particularly for the morbidly obese patient for VTE prophylaxis. I think that's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joel Yohizline.
Thank you. Could you give us the best place to find the current recommendations for VTE 1 and 2?
I can send a table that summarizes it. I can send that to iPro today. It's in the hospital manual. But essentially, it's in the 2004 CHEST supplement that was published in November of 2004 in the chapter on prevention of venous thromboembolism. Lead author was Bill Gertz, G-E-E-R-T-S. There are I think five or six authors, two of them orthopedic surgeons, but that is the internationally recognized guideline on prevention of venous thromboembolism.
And the table that you'll send to us, those will meet the performance measures?
Yes, yes.
That would be very helpful.
Thank you. I'm showing no further questions.
Thank you again so much, Dr. Braslow, for that excellent presentation, and thank everyone for their participation and their questions, and also for staying online. I know we went a little over hour, but I'm sure the time was worth spent. Before we conclude the call, I just want to remind everyone to please take a few moments to complete the evaluation form that was included in the handout materials and forward it to us at your earliest convenience. And I also would like to remind everyone of the next IPG conference call, which is scheduled for January 10th at 10 a.m. And, again, information on the call will be forthcoming. At this time, we can conclude the call, and have a nice day, everyone. Devin?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I don't know if you want to check the lines one more time if anyone has any questions.
Actually, we have one last final question from Cindy Pena's line.
Oh, sure. Go right ahead.
Dr. Neil Kurtz again. Regarding the use of tourniquets for total knee replacement and antibiotic prophylaxis, is there any minimum period of time prior to the inflation of a tourniquet that parenteral antibiotics have to be administered so that the tissues have appropriate antibiotic levels at the time that the tourniquet is inflated, since no additional antibiotics will be delivered to the tissue subsequent to the inflation of the tourniquet?
Are you there?
The doctor did disconnect, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.